So I just found out today, Jamie, that you were on an episode of
Singled Out. And now your host, Chris Hardwick.
Thanks, Tammy. Well,
yes, I was on the popular MTV game show Singled Out in 1995.
Number five.
This is Jamie, and I like your smile.
Cool.
And looking at it, it's almost looking like looking at a completely different person.
Sure. I was 20 years ago? 20 years ago.
20 years ago today.
No, it was, I think, probably September or October, 95.
Okay.
It was my first semester of college at UC Santa Barbara.
And what did you want to do with your life 20 years ago?
I wanted to be a hip-hop producer.
Yes.
Yes.
Had you done any hip-hop production before?
I had a sampler, so I was making beats in my dorm room. And I had a radio show, a hip-hop, underground hip-hop radio show at KCSB.
But today, you're not a hip-hop producer.
Not per se. I do actually still like to make beats and...
But you produce comedy shows.
But yes, it's evolved into being a comedy producer.
And you're now the booker at the Hollywood Improv.
Yes.
Where just last night...
Yes.
You got a phone call from... Singled Out host Chris Hardwick.
Oh, yes. Chris hit me up. He's working on new material. And so he will hit me up from time to time to come do a set at the club.
Did you ever think 20 years ago that you might be working professionally with Chris Hardwick?
No, of course not. He was the MTV host of a show. I was a hip hop kid in Santa Barbara.
Do you like where you're at today in life?
I do like where I'm at today in life. It's not exactly how I planned it. I don't think it ever is. It's been a weird road since I decided to take on comedy in earnest as a career. And I always loved being in front of the camera, and now I'm mostly behind the scenes, but I'm okay with that and still find my spots to perform when I can.
And today we're talking about just that. When your expectation is vastly different than reality. And you're okay with it. Welcome to the CISO C Show. I'm Andrew Steven. Today on our show, we have another story where expectations and reality don't quite see eye to eye. It's a story from Mike Bonifer. It involves Bill Murray, screenwriting, family, and it's a story about looking for something, only to realize you've had it all along. Here's Mike.
Is this where I tell my story?
Please, tell your story.
The story begins on a farm in Indiana where I grew up. My father collected horses that other people didn't want. We had a farm full of cast-off horses that had issues. Horses with one leg shorter than the other, horses with one lung, horses with albino eyes and sway backs and biting problems. He was determined to rescue and rehabilitate horses. And little by little, over the time that I grew up there, our farm turned into a theme park built around these rehabilitated horses, Cloverleaf Park and Riding Stable. And it was one hell of a way to grow up, let me tell you. So flash forward 25 years, and I'm out in L.A., and I'm going through a series of crises in my life that challenged me on every level, financially, emotionally, personally, professionally. I was deeply challenged, and I felt as if I only had one thing, aside from my children, I only had one thing of value left in my life. And that was the story that I was born to tell, the story of my father and his horses and how we grew up on this farm that turned into a theme park and how he was a farmer who dreamed of being a cowboy.
How would you describe my father?
Your father?
This is from a recording Mike took, but we'll talk more about that later.
Unstoppable. Your father is immutable. He's... ebullient. Your father has reinvented himself a lot of times, and that's an interesting thing. He's done a lot of different things. He's had a lot of different dimensions. A lot of guys have a dad that get on the train every morning and go downtown to work and come back at night, do the same thing every day for 30 years, get a gold watch, and then move to Arizona. That ain't your dad. You had a much more interesting dad than that.
So I decided that I would tell this story. I called it The Legend of Cowboy Bob. I wrote it as a screenplay. I wrote it 11 times. And it turned into a beautiful screenplay. There is a lot of material. There's probably enough material to make 5 movies. So it turned into 11 screenplays, different variations. And quite a few people were interested in buying the screenplay. I was in LA, super focused on this story. But I insisted that Bill Murray have the right of first refusal to play Cowboy Bob. The reason being that in the mid-80s, when he had made the film The Razor's Edge, I was sent to New York by Columbia Pictures to interview Bill Murray.
Columbia Pictures presents Bill Murray.
This isn't the old Mr. Sunshine.
In The Razor's Edge.
And so we spent the morning on the roof of his penthouse apartment on the Upper West Side, drinking Löwenbräus and talking and shooting the shit. And the interview was a very small part of it. It was a wonderful experience, about like you think it would be, meeting Bill Murray and hanging out and shooting the shit and talking about Belushi, who had died not long before, and talking about Ghostbusters and talking about doing one for yourself and one for the studio and talking about fame and the price of fame. And he is a wise man. He has a lot of wisdom, and he's lived and seen a lot. But the most profound thing about it was he's the only person that I've ever met in my life that reminded me of my father. And it didn't have as much to do with physical resemblance as it had to do with a vibration. They vibrated at the same unique frequency. And I got the feeling in his presence that I got being around my dad, who was this totally unique character. So when the screenplay was finished, people wanted to buy it. And I said, no, Bill has to see it. And he gets to decide whether he wants to play this character, because I wrote it with him in mind. For 7 weeks, the whole apparatus as I knew it in Hollywood, including agencies and managers and producers, were trying to find Bill Murray. None of them could do it, and I was going increasingly crazy because now I didn't have this writing to do anymore. I had no focus. And finally, after 7 weeks of this, I said, forget it, quit looking, call off the search, I'll find him myself. I got in the car, in my car, with a video camera, and I started driving. I drove across the United States and back, and every single person I met along the way, I asked them on camera if they had seen Bill Murray.
No, I haven't seen him, but since you're looking for him, I'll try and find him. But my guess is he's gone somewhere where there's a lot of wilderness and very few people to be in kind of a solitude kind of thing, because I've heard that about him. He likes that me time.
That was Gary Coleman. Mike also asked Kelsey Grammer.
Last time I saw Bill Murray, I was at the Malibu golf course, the public course.
I played it many times.
And Bill was walking out with a buddy walking towards some car. I forget what kind of car it was. And he said, don't touch the car.
James Carville.
South Africa, New Zealand, I don't know. I got a sense he's in the Southern Hemisphere somewhere.
And Corey Feldman.
Well, I guess you got to do 6 degrees of Bill Murray. You know what I mean? Obviously, Bill Murray worked with, you know, Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd for many years. So, you know, go to one of those guys, ask them to ask their agent. You know, if they don't have a personal number on him, then they definitely would, at least their agent would know whose agent Bill Murray's agent is, and then get Bill Murray's agent to give you Bill Murray's manager's number. No?
Bill Murray's agent and management doesn't know where
they don't know where he is.
That's the whole thing.
I was headed to what I would call a number of touchstones along the way. So I had friends to visit. I had places that I knew Bill had been in the past. I wasn't looking for him. I wasn't going and going, well, he's likely to be in a certain place, or I have an address, or there's an 800 number. I was invoking the spirit of Bill Murray. So Regis College in Denver, Wrigley Field, but also a lot of friends along the way, a jazz drummer from living in Downers Grove who went with me and his two young daughters to Wrigley Field. And it was, in a weird way, it was therapeutic to me, and it was a way for me to get my footing again in life and find my focus. And my friend in Chicago in particular, after we had come back from a day at Wrigley Field where I'm asking all these drunken people, it was a doubleheader with the Brewers, and I'm asking people if they've seen Bill Murray.
What's the secret to being a Cubs fan? How can you do it, man?
Beer.
Lots of it.
Make this guy's movie, Bill. Yeah, make this guy's movie. He's desperate.
Tell him I loved him in Ghostbusters.
I liked him in What About Bob?
And keep pursuing your dreams, man.
And my friend and I are sitting that night in his basement, and he's playing the drums, and he's talking about drumming and his start, and he's talking about our friendship, and he goes, you know,
I don't think you're crazy. I think there's a difference between being crazy and being nuts. I think you're nuts. Something that we've shared since the day we met, when we both found out that we were, you know, we both grew up on farms and we both come from incredibly hardworking families. You know, both of our dads worked till they can't work anymore, you know, and I don't think that you could have picked anything else that you should be doing right now, because I see it while you're doing it, I seen you doing it, and I see that it's not a question of whether you should be doing it or not, which is the way you should play an instrument. You just do it.
And so Mike continues on his road trip, heading to New York in search of Bill Murray.
People wanted to be part of the quest. People would offer to cook for Bill if Bill showed up. People would volunteer to be in the movie. There were all kinds of beautiful things that happened. And my friend and I were headed to New Canaan, Connecticut, where a buddy of ours from college named Pete Demmerle, who was the golden boy when we were in college, he was a Rhodes Scholar. He was an All-American football player at Notre Dame. He had ALS. He was dying of ALS. He had lost the power to speak. And so we got to this beautiful home, this Cape Cod home in New Canaan. And for a while, we thought we were at the wrong address because there was no answer. And I went back to check my notes, and I said, I think this is where Pete lives. And all of a sudden, we saw a shadow move in front of the window, and you go, holy shit, that is Pete Demmerle. That's the golden boy, and he's got a walker. And he couldn't talk to us. He had to guide us back into his den, and then he's gesturing, and we're sort of guessing what he wants. Do you want us to set up the chessboard? Do you want us to turn on the TV? What do you want? What do you want? And we finally figured out he wanted his voice synthesizer. And I'm really there to ask him if he had seen Bill Murray and catch up with him. So he taps out a message on his voice synthesizer, and he hits send. And the voice says, "Who will wipe my ass?" And that was all we needed to have the greatest time that I ever had with Pete Demmerle.
It's a blend of Kentucky bluegrass and sansevieria. You can 36 holes in the afternoon and be stoned all night.
Some guys just don't know how to tell a joke.
We actually thought he was going to die laughing. He was on a ventilator, and for a minute, he was laughing so hard and drooling, and he was literally dying. And my friend said later, I wish he would have died laughing.
Oh, I wanted him to die when we were with him. I wanted him to die laughing. I hope he's happy every day for the rest of his life.
It was the most joyous, carefree, no-holds-barred laughter, and it was mostly shit jokes. It was mostly just stuff that he was wrestling with. And I got back to Los Angeles three or four weeks later, and I had this vast compilation of footage, hundreds of short interviews I had done where I had asked people if they had seen Bill Murray. And I cut it together into a 10-minute highlights reel, and I started showing that to people in the industry, and I would videotape them while they were watching it, and then I would ask them, after they had watched it, are you going to help me find Bill Murray? And people were really inspired by the journey, by the quest, and so they began helping me. And the path eventually led to Bill's youngest brother, Joel. Someone knew Joel.
That's me. I've always been a boxer's guy, and Billy. My brother Ed, who's the oldest. My brother Brian. My brother Andy, who's the restaurateur, and my brother Johnny there.
So I show the 10 minutes to Joel. And Joel and his wife, Eliza, were there watching it. And at a certain point, my dad, I had stopped on our farm, and my dad was in the video. And Eliza goes, that's
the man that could convince him.
Right there. And I go, well, of course, because they're the same guy. They're kindred spirits. You know, of course my dad could convince him. But my dad's not going to come out to L.A., so we have to convince him. So Joel agreed to help me get the screenplay, get the project in front of Bill. There was, however, a price of admission, because I am far from the only person that has approached Joel Murray and said, hey, can I get something to Bill? And Joel joked about that, like, oh, nobody ever gives me things to take to Bill. But he read the script, and he liked it, and he had an idea for a screenplay that he wanted me to write with him. So we spent three mornings a week for 6 weeks writing this script. And throughout that process, Bill was lurking. Bill was like a ghost. He was there. He was present. So Joel would get a phone call, and it would be Bill. And he'd go, just a second, I got to leave the room. And I'd hear him in the next room, and he'd be going, yeah, he's here. Yeah, he's here. No, he's a nice guy. No, you should meet him. And he was just always slightly out of reach. And so finally came to a weekend where Joel and Bill were going to play golf together. And Joel goes, this is it. This is the time. So Bill has a ranch down south of Los Angeles. And they were going to hang out there, and they were going to play golf at this club nearby for the whole weekend. So I outfitted Joel with, I got my dad to send out one of his cowboy hats. And I had a copy of the screenplay, and I gave him one of my cameras. And I said, give Bill the screenplay. If he agrees to play Cowboy Bob, he's to indicate that by putting on the hat. Get the video. That's the contract of Bill wearing my dad's hat. That will be our contract.
So I went down there, and I'm thinking to myself, well, don't see, I just got to get Bill to read the script and watch the tape and then put on the hat while I'm videotaping him. I'm just thinking, how am I ever going to get this done, you know? So we go out and we play the golf, and the first day we played, you know, not so great, and I had a lot on my mind, apparently.
So now I'm waiting 48 hours of tension, of like all of it has come to this. All of this quest has come down to this weekend and Joel playing.
It came down to him, you know, helping me put my stuff in my car, and there's the script. I said, well, Bill, you know, at least I get this done, you know. Here's the script my friend Mike's been written and has been trying to get to you, and he just kind of thumbs through it. Well, you know what? Let me look at this. I'll get this right back to you. Let me just borrow this. And at that point, he picked up your dad's hat, and he tried it on, and surprisingly, it fit. I thought it's a little small on me. I always thought he had a bigger head. And for a second there, I was like, well, here it is. He's got the script in his hand. He's got the hat on his head. Wouldn't Mike be happy? But I gave him the tape, and he said, well, you know, yeah, I'll take a look at it. I'll see you. I'll talk to you soon.
He came back on Monday. I was in there, and he goes, well, it's sort of a mixed bag. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, well, I went out to the corral, and he goes, I think you'll be interested in the footage. So he handed over this video to me, and he showed me Bill's horses, and they were the spitting image of my dad's horses. Albino-eyed horses, swayback mares with half a tail, miniature mules, and all. They could have been right out of our corral when I was growing up. So that was the footage I had. So I go, well, Bill has actually been Cowboy Bob all along. And as Joel and I were working on this screenplay, I began assembling my dad's story of how we grew up. And so I captured that. And so I made a documentary called Finding Bill Murray that was me telling Bill my dad's story in an effort to get Bill to be in a story about my dad. And we showed it projected on the side of our barn a week before my dad died to 200 family and friends at Magic Hour. It was the most beautiful thing that has ever happened to me in my life. I had my camera because I wanted to shoot this tableau in front of me, and it took immense physical effort to even raise the camera because I was transfixed, because I was going, this is it. This was the destination all along. This is what it was meant to be. I was never meant to find Bill Murray. This is what I was meant to find. I was meant to spend the last 2 years of my dad's life talking to him. I was meant to get these people together. I was meant to pay this homage to my father. And I told the story, which is really what I wanted to do all along. And that was the end of the quest. I never had to find Bill Murray because, as it turns out, he was fully present. He was a participant in the game. And as we say in improv, don't solve the problem, and the game will keep on.
Mike first told this story of finding Bill Murray to Christine and Hannes from Storyworthy Podcast. But since then, there's been some update on the legend of Cowboy Bob.
People hired me for work because they were inspired by this quest. I got far more work than if I had sold the screenplay, made way more money than if I had sold the screenplay. Joel and I are still friends, and there's been interest lately about the screenplay that Joel and I wrote together.
Just a couple days ago, I got an email from Mike, and I have it right here. It says, "Hi, Andrew. FYI, a producer from Australia who read the script for The Legend of Cowboy Bob 17 years ago contacted me out of the blue. Turns out she'd met someone, moved to Australia to get married, had kids, got out of film and into TV while she raised her kids. Then she raised her kids, got back into the film business last year. The Legend of Cowboy Bob was the first story she thought of. She remembered it all those years later. And 6 weeks ago, she optioned the screenplay to make it into a feature film. And that's how we roll. Thanks for help keeping the story alive." So the game of Cowboy Bob may be ending, but there are plenty more left to be played. Thanks so much for listening, and special thanks to Mike Bonifer and the Storyworthy Podcast. If you want to hear a longer interview with Mike, I'll put a link in the show notes. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter at CESO Show. That's S-E-E-S-O Show. And while you're at it, if you feel like it, tell your friends to follow us. Anyways, I hope you all have a great week. Bye.